George Saunders is considered one of the great masters of the short story. He's now written his first novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, a novel that comes from the real-life death of Willie Lincoln, the 11-year-old son of Abe and Mary Lincoln, in 1862. The novel, just published in paperback and winner of the Man Booker Prize, proceeds through 166 different voices to assemble a portrait of the cemetery's undead residents, as well as a violently divided America and its grief-stricken president. George Saunders is the author of 8 books, including story collections such as 10th of December, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. Again, the name of the new novel is Lincoln in the Bardo, and it's a great pleasure to welcome George Saunders back to the roundtable. It's always a great pleasure to have you on this program, sir.
And it's a pleasure to be here, Joe.
Thank you very much for taking the time. So the last time we talked, Lincoln in the Bardo, I think it was the day it was being released, and you were getting ready to go on this exhaustive tour, which you're still on, I guess.
Yeah, I'm on a different branch now.
That's right, a new branch with the paperback. So you were curious. I remember you saying that you were curious to see how this book would be received by people and through book events, given that when you were writing it, there was a sense of, oh, well, probably Hillary Clinton will be president. And then the book comes out about 2 weeks after the inauguration of Donald Trump. What did you find? What has this last year been like talking about a book about Lincoln in the age of Trump?
Yeah. You know, it was so great, actually, because that I did something like 28 cities in the U.S. in 30 days right after we talked. And every crowd was just energized with this, you know, kind of latent or not so latent energy about the election. So it was kind of it was refreshing to, you know, at the point in the evening when you, the question would come, you know, or you'd turn the conversation to Trump, you could feel people really engaged. You know, they just wanted to talk about that and want to think about it. And the book turned out to be a pretty good entree into that. So at first I thought, oh my God, this is going to be really strange, but it was quite wonderful to see kind of what American intellectual life looks like when it gets energized by something like that. So many good readers and passionate political people who were basically showing up to say, is there anything in literature that can help us kind of, you know, navigate through this? So it felt like a very vital thing, which was really nice.
What do you think it is about your story specifically, about the life of Abraham Lincoln more broadly, that allowed that conversation and was such a good match?
Well, one thing I think was just that, you know, pretty much anybody from any political persuasion has some fondness for Lincoln. He's a very easy guy to project onto. So to kind of be contemplating this towering figure who was at the helm during this difficult time of national division seemed instructive. And for me, I in writing the book, you know, long before Trump presidency, I kind of got a new dose of something like patriotism, just to sort of say, wow, this country's interesting. You know, it's a weird place. It's got a great idea that it's never quite, you know, fulfilled, but we're trying. And so when I finished the book, I was kind of newly alert to this American thing. And then along comes the election. So I think a lot of people had that feeling. The other thing we talked about a lot was just the notion that, you know, you can put your mind on a lot of things, and your mind can function at a lot of different registers. When you're reading a novel or writing a novel, that mind is pretty expansive. You know, it takes a lot. It takes a lot of doubt and a lot of confidence and a lot of comfort with ambiguity, both for reader and writer. And we tended to talk a little bit about how different that particular manifestation of your mind is compared to the one, you know, sort of on politics, where you're immersed in social media, immersed in partisan cable news and so on, and how that mind is different. It's, I would say it's less, it's agitated, it's accusatory, it's defensive. So I think I came back from that tour thinking, wow, you know, even though I've been an artist all my life, I've kind of underestimated how important an intense sort of muscular relationship to art is for a culture's overall health.
So how about for that of the writer? We talk about how a readership that has just witnessed the election of Donald Trump responds to your work. For you as a writer, that wasn't going on. This book dates back to starting it in 2012. Were there current events? Were there things that were as you look at it now, that were bubbling up, that were a part of the conversation that you were having, that you see had an influence in the writing of the novel?
I think what happens is if a writer's doing his or her job correctly, they're basically really wide open to their subconscious. And the subconscious, in turn, is really wide open to the world in general. So I'm never aware of directly, you know, writing to politics. But my theory is if you've got your eyes open and you're in the world in a kind of a genuinely curious place without too much agenda, then data's coming in all the time. And actually, what I'm calling the subconscious is really, really good at anticipating things. It's not psychic, but it's when you're in the world of making a story, your senses are wide open, and you pick up on things that your conscious self doesn't. So this, I've had other books that were kind of predictive of this Trump moment. Actually, they were written 10 or 8 or 9 years ago. So I'm not sure. I know I was doing a lot of traveling for GQ magazine during the period this book was sort of working in my mind. And one trip in particular, I went to a homeless camp in Fresno and lived in there for a week, kind of incognito. And I think a lot of stuff from that experience got into this book, ranging from the loneliness in there and the way that people would repetitively tell you stories in an attempt to connect with you. And also, I think in a bigger way, the kind of the politics of it, you know, that in this incredibly rich country, there's these, you know, these people who are living in just hell realms, you know, a mile or two away from affluence. Somehow that got into the book in terms of these ghosts who are living such miserable lives in the midst of the, you know, the beauty that is actual life.
Anything about racism, considering you were writing about a time near the Civil War, the abolishment of slavery, and the parallels to what we're living through or we're living through at that time?
Right. Well, I mean, there are some former slaves who live in a kind of a, or, you know, reside in a kind of a mass grave off to the side. And, you know, in writing those characters, I think I, kind of got made reaware of the fact that actually not that much has been done, or that the extent of the injustice that we visited on these fellow countrymen of ours for such a long time has never really been addressed. You know, we're in a kind of a national denial about what an incredible hardship, you know, sacrificing the fruits of your toil for 500 years would put on people. And I think we've sort of, and I certainly did it, you know, it's post-racial. We're over that. And writing the stories of those four or five former slaves made me think about it a little more deeply. And now I think, you know, this is kind of what's going on. The Trump thing has kind of burst a lot of boils in terms of race and gender and all these things. So I think I never would have anticipated, but I can see in looking at the book that my mind was sort of moving in that direction.
And when I got the paperback, I reread the novel, and you forget how complicated it is, how complex it is, which is beautiful through all of these voices. And I assume, and I think we touched on this the last time we talked, that for you there really was no easier way to capture Abraham Lincoln.
We are, or actually, you know, to be honest with you, Joe, to avoid him, because that, you know, you start writing a book about Lincoln and it's just a terrifying thing. So one of the strategies was just to try to, you know, keep him on stage as little as possible so I could do as much justice to him as I could, you know, in those moments. I had no desire to make a kind of sweeping statement about him or his personality, but kind of just think, okay, he's just one of those 166 voices, you know, get in here, Abe, and I'll move it along, you know, kind of try to remember that, you know, he actually that night, what he really was a grieving father. And he was a grieving father that we're going to see maybe 5 or 6 times between 11 at night and maybe 2 in the morning. And so, it, you know, in a sense, with somebody like him, you kind of want to come up to him sideways a little bit and not look him directly in the eyes.
Do you like that for the reader, and I assume most readers approach it the way I did, and if not, just say yes and make me feel better, but which is that there are times where you're not quite sure what's going on, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that's actually one of the fun things about touring is you see that every, you know, a book has a kind of general response. And with this one, what I've heard so many times is I got to page 20 and I didn't know what was going on. And either I threw it across the room or, you know, I stopped. But at some point, if you can get past the first 20 or 30 pages, theoretically, the book sort of teaches you how to read it. And now the part where people throw it across the room, they also sometimes send me very angry emails. But that to me was an indication that, you know, if nothing else, it's not a tepid book and people respond to it one way or the other. But yeah, for sure. I think it's part of it is sort of by design in that, you know, if you're talking about the afterlife, it probably, you know, if a meteor hits the studio right now and I die, I'd be really surprised if what came next was expected. You know, I'm like, oh, yes, this is just the way I thought it would be.
Right.
So in making this afterlife, part of the thing was to, for me and the reader, to be a little disoriented and surprised that death is this thing, you know.
Okay, so now for the quintessential talk show question, which is, you say that you're 20 page, if you're reading it to maybe 20 pages in, and the book will eventually instruct you how to read it. For you as the writer, did it eventually instruct you how to write it, or did you know that from the very beginning?
No, it definitely instructed me. I just was kind of, I tried it a couple more conventional ways, and it just didn't seem to have any emotional power. And so I kind of blundered onto this form, which actually was sort of cobbled together from, you know, from another book I tried to write years ago, and from some observations of chat lines and all this, and a play I tried to write. So I kind of, you know, for me, the way this stuff works is really intuitive and really, really iterative. So you just go out in your writing place every day and fart around and see what happens. And at some point, you almost lose track of what you're doing. And you come in on Thursday and you read it, and suddenly it's doing something that you didn't know it was going to. So in this case, the form, which is kind of odd, I really kind of fell in love with it. And then you see that it's actually serving all of the emotional needs of the story. Then there's kind of a scary thing where you think, geez, I wonder if I'm out of my mind. Am I the only one who could understand this? That's the big step is when I'd written about a third of it, and I was really happy with it, but I was also partly aware that I might be nuts and that someone who wasn't as far inside of it as I was might just not be able to break the code. So I just gave it to my wife, which is what I always do. And we were together at Syracuse, and she's a great writer. And so I just, you know, basically waited for her reaction, and she put this little post-it note on it. It was such a nice thing that I keep it secret, but it was just like, yeah, this is totally understandable to a good reader, so plunge on ahead.
And once you plunged on ahead, is it, because there are so many voices, because there are so many points of view, is there almost a plotting of keeping that, and I don't mean in the writerly sense, but almost like a board on the wall to keep everything straight?
You know, there wasn't, and it was sort of a board in my head, I guess. I mean, I had, what I would do is every day, just about every day, I'd read it from the beginning. And so in that way, you can sort of have a three-dimensional picture of the place in your mind, a functional thing. And then, of course, if you're coming back through the graveyard in a place from a direction you've just come, you have to sort of re-encounter the same people. So there's kind of a general effort to keep the geography straight. But I didn't, I'm kind of wary of organizing. I'm a former engineer, and if you say to me, organize something, I go berserk. And in writing, what that does is, in organizing it, it quashes the intuition a little bit. So in other words, I start to believe that the power of the work is going to come from the extent of the organization. For me, it seems to work better to organize just a little bit and really trust what might be a greater kind of organization, which is that which your intuition provides you. So in this case, the only chart I had was something to remind me of when these ghosts, the main ones, were born and when they died. So I could kind of keep that straight. You know, some of them would be in the graveyard for 20 years before the other one showed up. And at some point I had a list of presidential order, just to know who was president when. And then at the end I kind of did a quick check to make sure that it was consistent. And so not too much plotting.
Kurt Vonnegut, before he passed, told me that he always considered himself to be a scruffy writer, that he didn't have the credentials really of a real writer, as he referred to it, and which is why he thought he never won awards or was ever picked for a Pulitzer or anything of the like. Do you consider yourself in that class, or do you feel that it's different? And the reason I ask the question is because your work does seem to connect with so many different types of audiences.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, I definitely, scruffy is a nice way to put it for me. I'm, you know, my background is in engineering, and I feel very confident that I can sit down and write a story and improvise it and kind of be an entertainer. But if I'm put in a position where I need to speak about it intellectually, I always feel very rickety. You know, I'm not the kind of person who's read everything and can quote it at length. And often I find that the ideas that I express in that mode are kind of stupid. You know, I get home and go, but that doesn't even make sense, you know. So I figured this out kind of early, and I thought, well, you know, actually the job that I love and that I embraced was to just, you know, give me 3 years and I will give you a story that will hopefully get inside you and move you and change you. That's doesn't actually require any talking, you know, or any reference to other works. And I think, weirdly, it doesn't even require a conceptual idea of your own place in a lineage. You know, you might have an instinctive feeling for it, but I've taken a lot of comfort in that because definitely a scruffy writer, very kind of hazy, spasmodic thinker. But then again, I don't really tout myself as a thinker, but just as a storyteller.
The novel is Lincoln and the Bardo. It did win the Man Booker Prize winner. The collection was up for the National Book Award. So what does it mean to win those prizes and to have that that spotlight of getting a major prize like that?
Well, I'm a rickety enough person that it means a lot, you know, it props you up in a certain way. And now I wish I was so secure that it didn't matter, but it does. So I just try to say, well, all right, that's great. I mean, these you know, wonderful people who are putting the time in found some value in your work. And I just try to convert that right away into some kind of, you know, daring to be applied to the next book. So in other words, you know, you get up and sing a song, people clap, you go, oh, maybe I could sing a harder song. That's the only thing that I think is profitable. I mean, it gives you, of course, a bigger megaphone and more opportunities to travel, and I hope to use that responsibly. But the main thing is just to plow it under and say, okay, as crazy as you thought that book was, you actually were communicating to readers. So be, you know, in the time that's left, be bold.
This a two-part question, one having to do with the touring part of it, of touring last year when the book first came out after the inauguration, and now touring for the paperback. Of course, you wrote about Trump rallies that you attended for New Yorker magazine. Have you seen any differences from having toured the country so extensively? I ask you this question. Have you seen differences in people's reactions from 2 years ago to a year ago to what you're seeing perhaps today?
Well, I have to be honest and say one of the weird things about doing a book tour is that you mostly run into progressive people. You know, you go to,
sure.
And so you're preaching to the converted. There have been a couple, you know, there are times where with this book, especially with Lincoln, you will attract a more varied crowd. I think there's, my gut instinct is that there's a percentage of people who voted for Trump who are having real buyer's remorse, and that if the Democrats would approach those people skillfully, they could get them. Because I think there's a basic American decency that, you know, that values somebody with a little bit of self-deprecation, which is not the case, somebody with a sense of humor about himself, somebody who's genuinely concerned for people who are having trouble. And so I think that the problem is, I think sometimes the progressive approach can get a bit shrill, and those people go into a defensive crouch. So that's kind of my instinct. The other thing that's been really heartening is that the audiences, the progressive audiences, are you know, they're kind of energized, and they they're doing the right thing, which is to kind of double down on logic, you know, truth, reason, reading. And then when the moment comes when the country actually has to make some decision about this mess, those people will be not in a state of despair. You know, they'll be clear-headed, and they'll be ready to do what needs to be done.
But as you said, you know, I reread the book, and one of the things that kept on coming through my mind was, well, you know, this our president certainly ain't no Lincoln.
Right. Well, that's a high bar. But you know, the thing is, you know, the thing I love about fiction writing is that it encourages you to, you know, and it helps you learn how to keep a bunch of ideas in your head at once. So the thing that I've kind of not liked about this political moment is that it's so binary. You know, the and this conceptual axis that we're being sort of force-fed both by reality and the media is everything is left versus right. So I'm trying to just, you know, empower myself by putting a different conceptual axis in place, which is, you know, maybe moral, ethical, or spiritual, and say, let me be confident enough and attentive enough to see if I can imagine the country in a different way. This left-right thing is a little, to me, it's a little DOA. I mean, it's right. So reductive, and there's a course of truth to it, but it seems to be separating us and making us less articulate. And, I smell money in it a bit. There's some kind of corporate agenda that in the media outlets and so on and other places that seem to like this. It seems to like the division. And it's a little bit like a really dysfunctional family. It's fine as long as everybody's healthy and life is good. But when somebody loses a job or there's an earthquake or a kid gets sick, you don't want to be in a household where the division is so close to the surface and so facile. So I think we actually are in a bit of a crisis, even if, you know, we change presidents tomorrow, even if whatever, the underlying problems are very deep. And I think it's maybe only in a culture that's been as fortunate as ours that we can take it so lightly. You know, you look at the history of the world, and when countries become this dysfunctional, some really terrible things can happen if there's one other disaster added to the mix. So I'm optimistic, Joe.
Well, that's good. I think that helps a lot.
Yeah.
The name of the novel is Lincoln in the Bardo. It is out in paperback from Random House. George Saunders, it is always a great honor and a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me back, Joe. I really appreciate it.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, Lincoln in the Bardo, a novel out in paperback now from Random House. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.